Welcome, everybody. Those of you who have been with us all summer know that this is our 74th lecture for the summer, and it's only appropriate that we have the 74th Treasury Secretary of the United States of America. I'm exaggerating, I think, about the number of McCluskey lectures we've had, but I'm not exaggerating about the number of Treasury Secretaries. But from Alexander Hamilton to you, it's been a great office. He also has dealing with China, and guess what? There's our friend John, right? Yeah, who's over there. I can't see with the lights from Explore, so you can get the book later. And after you get your stock tips about what to do on the Asian market, you can buy a dozen of them, and he will sign them all. Speaking of which, in your book, you talk about China debt. You talk about the economy heading for some real bumps. It's happened. What's happening with the Chinese economy?
Okay, Walter, first of all, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. A beautiful day in Aspen to see so many friends in the audience. So the Chinese economy. The Chinese economy is slowing down significantly. The premier, Li Keqiang, has talked about a new normal of being 7%. I think that's rather optimistic. I don't focus as much on the rate of growth because I think you have to expect that. But what I focus on is how do they fix a economic model that is run out of gas?
Why is it run out of gas?
Okay, because they've been so reliant not only on exports, but on infrastructure investment funded by municipal debt. And some of it needed, some of it not needed. And so you've had this big run-up in debt that's growing quicker than the economy, and it's not sustainable. So the leaders understand this. They're focused on the problem, but it's easier said than done to reboot a $10 trillion economy. And this is going to take some fundamental reforms in terms of fixing a broken municipal finance system, developing a new tax system, national tax system, changing the responsibilities between the center and the provinces. And then if they're going to get growth, they're going to need to rein in the state-owned enterprises and, you know, create more opportunity for the private sector companies, which is where the growth has got to come from. So that's all easier said than done. So they need to reboot this economy, plus manage this debt problem. And so, as I said in the book, I take comfort from the fact they've got the financial capacity to deal with it. They've got the leaders understand the problem. But to all of those who think they've developed a better form of capitalism, let me tell you that ain't the case. And this is going to be difficult, and there will be bumps in the road.
Now, the stock market correction we've seen in the past couple of months, how fundamental is that, and how much will that continue?
Okay. So say one more thing about the economy than the stock market. Economic reform has stalled for 10 years. And so this management team had a really difficult set of problems it was presented with. And so they laid out reforms to deal with it, where they said the market needs to be decisive. Okay, so they said the market needs to be decisive. The reforms that they've outlined say that. And so then what they've had is they'd had a big, you know, run-up on the stock price. And of course, the definition of a bubble is no one fully understands that the market doesn't understand it until it bursts. And so there was a correction, a big decline in stock prices, a big decline in terms of single-day moves, but not big declines relative to how far the market had run up.
Do you think the renminbi or yuan devaluation, what caused them to do that in the last 3 days?
Okay, so I'm going to get to that, but I just want to say one more thing about the Chinese government intervened to prop up the equity market, and they did it probably because so many unsophisticated individual investors had gone into the market with the assumption that the government, you know, was somehow going to have the capacity to hold the market up. And the point that I made here, which I think is very important, is this isn't the thing to really be looking at. The fundamental problem is restructuring the economy. Now, this big equity market sell-off makes it more difficult to restructure the economy. It's hurt confidence, and I think it shows also how much more they need to do to reform their equity markets. And so if I have a big concern there, it's that the sell-off in the market might make it more difficult for the leaders to carry on with the reform. Okay, now you ask the equity market, excuse me, the currency. And as you, you know, and I'm, brevity is not one of my virtues. And
that's this one will take a while.
This is funny, but not that funny, you know. So I'm going to take a while because I want to say that currency is an important economic issue, and it's also a very important political issue, at least in the current Chinese currency in Washington, D.C. And as I write in the book, it's been overblown as a political issue because it's easy to call attention to. I don't think that the biggest issues in the Chinese economy have been currency. They've been structural issues and issues that, more important is to fight to open up the markets there. But the currency is very important. And when I was Treasury Secretary, which goes back, you know, 8 and now not 9 years, that I made a big point about continuing to reform the currency. I never said to the Chinese, your currency is undervalued, even though it clearly was undervalued. I just talked in terms of why it was important in their best interest, because they were never going to get the economy they deserved or that they wanted to have unless they had a currency that was, you know, where the value was determined by market factors and sent a really, you know, legitimate price signal in the market. And given what they wanted to do, they someday wanted to have a reserve currency. They wanted to move up the value-added chain. All of this made sense. So I made that argument repeatedly. The Chinese leaders agreed with it. They have moved to liberalize their currency regime. And so what had happened in over this past 8 years, 9 years, is the currency had appreciated relative to the dollar, and then as it has stayed stable with the dollar as they've managed it, the dollar is appreciated. So the Chinese currency has really risen and appreciated relative to most of the rest of the world, to the point where there was a legitimate debate. Some people argued the currency was now overvalued. Some still thought it was undervalued. Whenever I got asked a question, I said, I don't know, and we need to get to the point where it's truly a market-determined currency so we won't be asking that question. But Washington continued, the politicians in Washington hadn't caught up with this and continued to beat on China for currency manipulation and unfair...
In other words, propping up their currency.
They were beating on them for having an undervalued currency, even though they had, in essence, been propping it up, okay? So that just shows you what a political issue was. So what happened Monday, which was very significant, two things happened at once, and I'll try to simplify this. They have a managed currency regime, and they announced a new methodology for managing the currency where there would be more flexibility, which everyone had been saying we needed to do to get to a market-determined currency, greater rate on market determination, on the market in determining the value, and they were going to be greater variability. And so they announced that at the same time they devalued by 2%. And so you had some folks led by the IMF that commended them for this because this is moving to a greater flexibility, looking more at market factors. And then they received a fair amount of criticism from those that were concerned that this might be the beginning of China seeking to get an unfair trade advantage, a big hot button political issue in Washington and concern. And this was happening the same time the Chinese economy was continuing to slow down, and there was some very unfavorable economic data that came out. And then the next two trading days, which is just through Wednesday, the currency is depreciated by 4%. And so, again, this is heightened the concern. If you look at it in economic terms, with the economy slowing down in China, it shouldn't be a shock that the currency is depreciating. So now, what does it all mean? And I think it means four things as I look at it right now. The first thing I will say is that the fundamental issue is what's going on in the economy. And there's no way that China is going to be able to turn around their economy by devaluing the currency. Ultimately, that will be self-defeating. And what all of us should be watching very, very carefully is what happens in the economy, because for all those that are sort of hoping that China has problems, they better be careful what they wish for, because if China has real problems there, all of our problems, you know, are going to become greater economic problems. So keep your eye on the economy, number one. Secondly, with regard to currency, to me, this really shows how important it is for China to keep moving with the reforms so we get to a currency that really is market determined, so we're not going through all of this uncertainty about the currency. China is an anomaly, that there are many developing countries that don't have market determined currencies, but there are none that are the world's second biggest economy and that are integrated into the trading system but not into the financial system. So they really need to speed that up, and that is very important. Thirdly, It in terms of the immediate term, it is very important that as China manages this currency, they do it very responsibly and prudently. This is in their best interest and the best interest of the rest of the world. And I believe that the leaders understand that, and I take some comfort from the fact that the central bank, PBOC, has been quoted as saying that they believe it's important that the renminbi the value be maintained at a basically stable level. So that was the language they used.
So it'll stay within a 2% range.
Well, I don't know. No, they haven't been clear what they've said. You know, they devalued 2%. It's now 4% in the first 3 days. Market forces are currencies. This has roiled markets around the world, equity markets, currency markets, commodity markets, because there's two things going on at once here. There's the overriding issue, what's going on in the Chinese economy. It's slowing down markedly. What does that mean for commodities markets around the world? What does it mean for economic growth? And then there's what is going to happen with the currency. And so I just think it is very much in China's interest. And again, they've said that, you know, basically stable. The fourth and the last point I make is you can bet everything involving China seems to be a big political issue. And you can bet if this was a big political issue, currency manipulation, so-called in Washington, when the renminbi was being held up relative to the global currencies, while others are driving their currency down, you can imagine it's going to be an even bigger political issue today.
And in Asian countries as well, which may lower their currencies?
Well, yeah, that's the concern, that if there's too much movement, you'll have a currency war. But right now, if you look at what's happened to the other Asian currencies, they're all coming down in the market, just coming down because not only what's happening to the Chinese, but concerned about the Chinese economy. Because basically, you know, this is an oversimplification, but currencies are often a proxy for what's happening in an economy. A slowdown in the Chinese economy means a slowdown in a number of these Asian economies, hence their currencies are going down.
You said moments ago two things that seem slightly contradictory to me, but maybe I don't understand it, which is they should let their currency be market, the value of the currency be more determined by the market, and they should also keep it stable. Well, don't that conflict?
Well, what's your, that's why this is a confusing area. right now you don't have a market. If they got to the point where they had a true reserve currency, what would they have? They would have a floating currency determined by markets, an open capital account, freely convertible currency.
And should they have that?
That's what they should get to.
Okay.
And in order to get there, I think they've got to have open, competitive, world-class capital markets. And I think there are ways from there. I think they're moving in that direction. So while, as long as they have a managed currency, I think it is very important that they do this prudently and very responsibly, and it's in their best interest. If the renminbi were to drop significantly, you would have capital flight. Investors wouldn't want to, would think more carefully before investing there, etc.
The devaluation makes it cheaper for their goods here, and the slowdown of the economy means that inflation in the United States has probably been tempered slightly by this devaluation of the currency. Does that mean in your mind that the Fed will have less pressure to raise interest rates this fall?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that. When I was Treasury Secretary, I didn't comment on the Fed, and I think as a former Treasury Secretary, I shouldn't comment on it. I just will simply say it is just as a general proposition. I'm a big proponent of the Fed's monetary policy in the past. I think because for us to deliver and have grown at roughly 2% since the third quarter of 2009, while we delever, I think is important. But I think it gets to the point where it's ultimately self-defeating. And we need to get to a point where assets trade on the basis of real economic value, and I think that if all it took was to have cheap money to solve all economic problems, people would have done that a long time ago. And so there's risks of bubbles and other things. But I think the reason that this is a difficult judgment for the Fed is we have plenty of headwinds ourselves. And as our dollar rises relative to other currencies around the world, and of course, what would Fed tightening do? It would cause the dollar to rise even further, which again creates headwind. So what the Fed is trading off is stability versus growth. And that's a judgment that I don't need to make. And we've got some very good people there, and I have real confidence in Janet Yellen.
Does this revaluation of the yuan actually help the United States?
Listen, I've said what I've... Okay. I've given you a long interview on currency. Okay. This is about China and the China
book. Let me go to your book then, which is, first of all, why did you write this book, and why do you think it's important for our political leaders to understand the complexities of dealing with China?
Well... there's a humorous answer and the second answer. The humorous answer, which is absolutely quite true, is when I said to Wendy, after having gone through writing On the Brink, which was a 9 months of, it wasn't fun for me. You would tell me that you found it relaxing, and late at night you would write and it helped you go to sleep. I'd write On the Brink and I couldn't sleep. And so, when I said to Wendy I was going to write another book, she said, "I think I might date again." It ended up taking me 3.5 years, and I'm not writing another one. But I wrote this. I dedicated this to my grandchildren, and I want my grandchildren and my children to grow up in a prosperous, safe world with a healthy environment and ecosystem, and I think that's much easier to do if we're working in complementary ways with China, and much more difficult if we aren't. I think that the U.S.-China relationship is increasingly fraught and complex, and there's going to be, certainly going to be increasing tension, and yet when I look at the major issues we need to deal with, whether they're the environmental issues from global warming to our ecosystem or sustaining global economic growth or denuclearization or fighting terrorism, whatever, they're going to be a lot easier to deal with if we're working with China, and very difficult if we're not. And so I just think that there's a lot of misunderstanding in the U.S. about China and vice versa. And so this was my real effort to deal with it.
What lessons did you learn from writing on the brink and from 2008 that applied to this book on China today?
Walter, an interesting question, because I have said always, when people ask me, shouldn't we be fearful that China was going to eat our lunch? I've said, guess what? I think you can make as big a mistake overestimating China as you can underestimating its potential, because they've got significant problems. And I've said that the best thing we can do in terms of dealing with China is deal with our own issues, because we are going to be the predominant power for a long time if we're dealing with, if we restore our economic competitiveness, if we do the things we need to do to get deal with our fiscal issues and with growth. And if we don't, we won't be. So, but what I learned and what I talk about in this book, which was a real lesson, I tell the story, which was in the strategic economic dialogue, which was something I put in place with, you know, in the, you know, with George, President George Bush's strong support to help manage the U.S.-China relationship, the economic relationship. And I tell the story when Wang Qishang, who is a major character in the book, was my counterpart, you know, as vice premier in during the strategic economic dialogue, he came to Washington in June of 2008. And he said to me, and I was pressing them to reform their capital markets. And he said to me, well, gee, Hank, you used to be our teacher, and we used to listen, but our teacher doesn't seem as smart anymore as he did. And, you know, that was, and he wasn't being a wise guy. He understood the need for them to continue with reforms, but it was much harder for us to be a leader and to press for reforms with the problems we had. And it just showed me in really graphic terms how important our leadership around the world starts with our economic leadership. If we want people to want to emulate our economy and look to our model, it's going to be hard to do if we don't continue to stay strong economically. If we want to exert influence around the world, it's going to be a lot easier if we're an economic leader, if we're the leader with trade agreements and with investment overseas, and if we're doing well at home. And there's no example anywhere in history where a power has continued to maintain its elite superpower status if they lose control of their fiscal situation. So I'll tell you, that is one thing that came through loud and clear to me. Let's fix our own problems, and you know, let's not look to others as a boogeyman. Let's not be worried about what others are going to do to us. Let's deal from a position of strength and fix our problems at home.
Great. Thank you. The book is called Dealing with China, and it's a great title because it has a few layers of meaning. Yeah. But it starts, or at least early on, you talk about your first visits to China, making deals with Goldman Sachs. I think John Thornton and others were involved with you there. How has dealing with China changed from then until now?
Well, there, again, Walter, a very good question, because there's three parts to the book. The first part is, as a Western banker dealing with the leaders there, when they used Western capital markets transactions to drive reform and bring competition and reform to the economy.
And privatize.
And privatize, right. And so it's changed in, certain things are the same and certain things are different. So first of all, I'll tell you what is radically different. In those days, I was working directly with top leaders in the country on capital markets transactions. And today, obviously, you wouldn't have Xi Jinping or Li Keqiang or the vice premiers dealing there. But these were very important. And I tell the story in there's a chapter entitled Real Gold and Silver, which was the story of taking China Mobile public, which was called China Telecom then. And we priced that right in the middle of the Asian financial crisis on Black Friday. And stocks traded off everywhere. But over time, this stock held its value. But right in the middle of the crisis, when Wang Qishang, who was our counterpart at the time, and it moved up with other reformers, when he called his boss, the legendary premier Zhu Rongji, to say, you know, this is closing, he said, what does that mean? Do we have our money? And Wang Qishang said, yes, real gold and silver. And Zhu said, I'll believe it when we have the $4.2 billion in our hands. And that was in the late 90s, so you realize how much they needed it then. But the things that have stayed the same is the lessons for working in China and how to get things done. And I would say I'll just make two of those lessons, amplify two of those lessons. One of them is that reformers, we tend to think of, because China is an authoritarian government, someone can just talk to a top leader and say, you know, why don't you do this, and then they can do that. And of course, it is very difficult to get things done in China because there's a lot of power that's devolved to the provinces. You know, there's the old saying that, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. And so it's very, very hard to build the consensus to get things done. And so it's often easier for Chinese leaders to use reforms as to use negotiations with the West as a way to get reforms done. Just as Zhu Rongji used the WTO negotiations to open up the economy. And today, the current leadership would like to use the bilateral investment trade negotiations. The other thing I would point out, which is related, is leadership is very diffuse. And so a few well-placed people can kill something, and it takes a lot of people to say yes. Mm-hmm. So even in a situation where the current leader, Xi Jinping, has aggregated power quicker than I think anyone since maybe Deng or Mao, there still is great resistance to reforms and vested interests. And so one thing I learned about decision making in China, you need to get to all the people that have the official responsibility for something, and a lot of others who don't, but who weigh in. And that's why we set up the Strategic Economic Dialogue, because it got, all of the top ministers of China in a room with the whole U.S. team. And so when we talked about currency reform, to come back to currency reform, rather than talking to the head of the central bank, Zhou Xiaotran, who is a reformer, and making the issues to him, when I wanted to make the issues as to the point as to why it was in China's best interest, I could turn to Ben Bernanke, and he would give all the economic arguments, and there'd be, 100 people in the room taking notes and all the other top ministers listening to it. So that attribute about decision-making in China is the same today as it was back in the early days.
What is Xi Jinping like personally, and what motivates him?
So, President Xi Jinping, so let me, I this is a leader I've known for some time, and I tell the story that when I was, as Treasury Secretary, my first trip to China, when I was going to Beijing to see President Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao in Beijing, over the State Department's protests, I stopped at Hangzhou first, and met with Xi Jinping. And I didn't know he was subsequently going to be named the vice president and then was going to become, you know, the general party secretary of the Communist Party and president. But I knew that he had placed a big emphasis on economic reform and the private sector as opposed to the state sector. And I had a high regard for him. I thought he was going to be moving up, and I wanted to send the signal that I didn't think the world revolved around Washington, D.C. and Beijing, so I went to Hangzhou first. And he had a great political sense then, because he arranged to have us photographed under the arch at Westlake, where President Nixon had met with Zhou Enlai. But so, now what is he like? A lot has been written about, he's unscripted, and he's someone who's a really good listener, and he's a very strong leader. But I would say there's three characteristics that really strike me about the guy. First of all, as I said earlier, he's aggregated power quicker than anyone I've seen to date. Secondly, there's no doubt in my mind that he's motivated by restoring China's greatness in the world. And to do that, he wants to modernize the country. And so that's the second thing I would say. Thirdly, I would say that he's got an extreme, maybe extreme, but a huge sense of urgency. Boggles the mind that he's looking at all at once changing almost every aspect of China in some way. The economic system, the social system, political system. So he's moving to try to reboot the economy, to develop a new urbanization model, the next 300 million people going to the cities. Imagine that, 300 million people over the next 20 years in China. They've already got 650 million people. He needs a new model for that. He's redone the legal system. The government bureaucracy, they don't have the institutions they need to manage. Changing the relationship between the center and the provinces. The new foreign policy, big changes in the military, and all of this through a party that's rife through corruption. And that's the other thing you need to understand about him. He sees the party and the preservation of the Communist Party as being of utmost concern. I think his number one priority is maintaining power of the Communist Party. He sees that as a source of stability in the country and the one institution that's strong enough to drive change.
Is that why he's cracking down on free expression and the internet, and will that work?
Yeah, so, okay, again, a very big question. I will try to be brief. Because what you see is someone, at the same time, he is liberalizing the economy, wants to do that, say, I want the markets to be decisive. So more flexibility and freedom in the economy. He's tightening up on the political system, on freedom of expression, on the internet, media, and so on. And we, as Americans, look at it and say that just doesn't fly. Those are contradictory. How do those two go together? To him, that doesn't seem to be because, again, he sees the party as being, as I said, the source of stability in the country, number one, and he takes a dim view of anything that's going to undermine the stability of the party. And now, in terms of my view on all of this, I'm going to answer it in two ways. First of all, the question is, why does that seem to be working today? Because at the same time he's doing that, he is focused big time on reforming the economy and dealing with that. He's focused on the other issues that people care greatly about, corruption. So he's got this massive anti-corruption campaign, hugely popular, you know, punished over 250,000 party members, 75, you know, minister rank or above. And so anti-corruption, dealing with, making a big attempt to deal with the environmental issue, which is a huge social concern, dealing with property rights. He's effectively done away with a one-child policy, you know, forced labor camps. So, but I ask myself, when you say, will it work? I look at it and say, I've run a global company, and I don't know how you innovate and how you run a successful global business and do it without being connected and having access to all the information you need. What's going on in every country, not only the economic system, the political system, the regulatory system. So I think it's ultimately self-defeating. But I think the other thing, when you get to the internet, one of the big concerns I have, and this is not limited to China, it's what I see in a number of other places. We all have this view, which is what it should be, is this global free internet. And I think we're in danger of having a segmented internet and a number of intranets that are connected. And so that's the experiment. I don't think it's going to work.
Does that mean they're not going to allow this book to be published in China?
Boy, I tell you, Walter, you get all the key questions. So in terms of this question...
Both authors. We like being published in China.
Right, right. And so I'd like the book to be published in China. And so I've said to them that this book will only be published in China if it will not be abridged, edited, censored in any way. And if it is... And if we can do that, it'll be quite remarkable, because you've read my chapter 19, The Party Line, and there are so many leaders that are major characters in the book. So what I've done, I'm proceeding with a publisher that I trust in China. They're going to make a best effort to clear it. If they can't clear it, then I'll have a high-quality translation, and I'll publish it somewhere in Hong Kong or somewhere where I can publish it, and I'll have a Chinese language version of this.
What are they pushing back on?
Well, that's just okay. That we'll wait and see.
The climate you just mentioned, and I know that's something you care about deeply, and you care about globally. In the book, there's a scene where you and Wendy see the wetlands, as a matter of fact. What do you think can be done, and you're doing with the Paulson Institute, of working with China on environmental issues?
Well, again, now you're really tempting me to be verbose, because the Paulson Institute is a think and do tank that we have 15 people in Beijing, 15 people here. We focus on U.S.-China and on economic issues and environmental issues in the intersection of both. And we have big effort when it comes to climate change and energy efficiency and a series of programs there working in particularly the Beijing, Hebei, Tianjin area, and a lot of the work on energy efficiency, because that's where the huge opportunities are. You know, half of, just as one example, you know, this is a country that produces, it's the world's second largest economy. It produces and consumes half of all coal, half of all cement, half of all steel. You know, 70% of the energy comes from coal, 20% from oil. This is an oversimplification. You know, only about 10% from renewables. A big effort on energy efficiency, and we do that. But conservation is another focus, because I care a lot about the global ecosystem. And one of the issues we focused on has been coastal wetlands, which are being destroyed in China, as they are elsewhere in the world, by reclamation, but very quickly. And so, again, the work there and that Wendy and I have done together has to do with, you know, commissioning studies on biodiversity in the coastline, so we identify those areas that are the most environmentally and ecologically rich, so hopefully they won't develop those, to actually working in, you know, in certain wetlands, working to set up parks. And the Paulson Institute has been, you know, tapped by Xi Jinping and the government to advise them and work as they set up a national park system. So again, this is a passion. It's just something Wendy and I have done, you know, around the world for a long time. And one of the chapters in the book, in the first part, is Saving Shangri-La, which is about this great, rich biodiversity in Yunnan, which a lot of the world is unaware of, and work to set up parks there.
Well, thank you for that, and thank Wendy for that, too. My last question before we go to the audience. As Treasury Secretary, you were the lead, I should say, in setting up the sanctions on Iran with our allies and partners on the nuclear deal. Now, leaving aside the details of the nuclear deal, do you think if that deal is not approved, that the sanctions regime in any way, shape, or form could stay in place?
Walter, several comments on that deal. And I will say it first, I'm not an expert on the Middle East, and I haven't studied the specifics of the deal. But I will make several comments, maybe three comments. The first one is that I think it's somewhere between naive and unrealistic to assume that after the United States of America has negotiated something like this with the five other, parties and with the whole world community watching, that we could back away from that and that the others would go with us, or even that our allies would go with us. That's the first thing. The second thing, I can just tell you how hard it is to craft sanctions, and that these, and unilateral sanctions and don't work, okay? They really have to be multilateral. And as someone who spent a lot of time dealing with the Europeans and Japanese and in looking at the financial system, I can just tell you how hard it was. And even when we found abuses and went to the governments to get their governments to enforce it. So it's a difficult thing. So I don't believe, I think it's totally unrealistic to believe that if we backed out of this deal, that the multilateral sanctions would stay in place. And I'm just trying to envision us sanctioning European banks or enforcing them, or Japanese banks or big Chinese banks. So again, the third thing I would say after, and again, not as an expert on this without qualification, I had a seat in Washington when we dealt with a big, intractable, messy problem where there weren't any neat, beautiful, elegant solutions. So you were deciding between doing something that was objectionable or doing nothing at all, which could even be more objectionable. So I don't particularly like it when people criticize something that's big and important that's been done if they don't have a better idea. So what I'd always say, okay, you don't like option A, what's your option B? Okay, and if there's not an option B, we went through that. I remember with when the money markets were imploding, and we were going to use the exchange stabilization fund to guarantee them, and so I heard people say, well, how do you guarantee, $3.5 trillion of money markets when you've only got the exchange stabilization fund is only $45 billion, or what kinds of aberrations or dislocations is that going to cause? And I said, well, if you got a better idea, do you want the money markets? And, if you don't have a better idea, fine, we'll do it. And so, again, so I'm not an expert on that, but I do know something about working on these sanctions and how difficult it is to put them in place.
In the way back, yes. I'll start there. Yes, sir. Oh, is that Amory? Or is it Amory's lookalike contest winner of the week?
Yeah, Amory Lovins, Rocky Mountain Institute. From our seat helping inform the 13 five-year plans, energy content and We sense a tipping point is happening right around now towards a greater emphasis on efficiency and renewables in China and moving pretty aggressively off coal. Does it look that way from where you sit? And secondly, if it turns out that that sort of trajectory that the U.S. is now on, actually, that we laid out in Reinventing Fire for the U.S., if that were a model for the developed world, and the similar thing that's emerging now in China were a model for the developing world, could the two together be a model for the world?
Well, first of all, I think most of the people know it. I'm talking to one of the foremost experts on climate change, energy efficiency, China, and so on. So,
Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute.
I would applaud you. So he's someone I read everything he writes. So I learn from him, and so on. So I will just start off with something. I just want to make this just obvious first before I answer your question. I think that the U.S.-China agreement on climate is historic. I think it is very, very important because we can't, you know, as much as what we do in the U.S. is important, the big emitters are going to be the developing nations, and with China the biggest. And so we can't solve the problem unless we're working with China. And I think with China, even though it's not binding, they've always been reluctant to put out targets because they don't want to put out targets they can't meet. And these targets, although hopefully they'll do better over time, are going to be challenging. You know, it requires some to meet them, number one. Number two, you are right that China is taking this very, very seriously. First of all, because dirty air is a huge flashpoint. It's killing people. The life expectancy is 5 years shorter in the coast, in the coastal areas and in the industrialized areas. And they also understand climate change. They, in 2008, you know, I tell the story in this book about going to the Qinghai Peninsula or plateau, and you know, looking at the glaciers melting, and then, you know, they understood this, but what we've found to date is that they have done a lot of very important things, and it's all been blown away by breakneck growth. And so when they need a better quality of growth, they need an economic model that isn't so carbon dependent. And I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a very ambitious 5-year plan to move to nuclear and renewables. Very ambitious. And you're going to see a big effort in the Beijing, Tianjin, Hebei area. And I'm encouraged by one thing in particular, that when you now talk with, when we go around and I talk to provincial leaders, party secretaries, mayors, governors, they used to just talk about growth, because what you needed to do to get promoted was create jobs, grow GDP, avoid big scandals, social unrest, and you got promoted. Now you hear air quality statistics, you hear a lot about the environment. So they're focused on it. But it's going to be difficult. It is not easy. The numbers, when you just look at their target of increasing the renewables from 10% to 20%, for the next 15 years, with that is the equivalent. I was looking at numbers the other day. This would be like for the next 15 years having a average-sized nuclear power plant go on online, or 500 big, wind turbines, or 200,000 solar panels. I mean, the numbers are huge, and the management challenge is very difficult. I wish I were as optimistic as you are, Amory. I have to be an optimist, or I wouldn't be spending all the time and money there and working on it. But I think it's a major challenge. I'm optimistic because they care and they're focused on it. And we've got no hope of meeting this challenge if they're not making big efforts. And so it's in our interest to really work carefully, closely with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the woman there, please.
My question is, you had, I have a political question. You talked about...
I'll repeat it. Keep shouting, yeah. Political question. Oh, here it is.
You talked about how the current leadership is focusing on making the Communist Party as strong as they can. Do you sense anything in the provinces or in the country that suggests that there might be another political party or more multi-plural kind of government over time? Is there any kind of dynamic you see there?
I've written in this book that Xi Jinping is characterized like so many Chinese leaders, but as being particularly pragmatic. So that's what I've seen over a career of working with them, that they look everywhere in the world they can for best practices and then figure out how to adapt it in China. I also say he is the most ideological leader that I've worked with. And so far, the pragmatism and the ideology haven't been in conflict in his mind, because this is a man who's quite popular, and he's, focusing on the issues that people care about. Over time, I really believe that this is a system that needs to evolve, and so the work that I'm doing is in the economic area and in the environmental area, where there is a real, a convergence of best interests. And I think we need to build more economic linkages. And so I want to build, I think that part of the tension we're going to have, and a growing tension between our two countries, are going to be in the national security area, some in the foreign policy area. And then I think the Chinese have a skepticism. They believe we're going to try to contain them, because they don't believe we're ever going to view as legitimate a kind of government that isn't a Western-style multi-party democracy. So you have a leader that says, I don't want a Western-style multi-party democracy, I don't want Western values, but I want a good relationship with the United States. So again, I believe that the more economic linkages we can forge that are good for both countries, and the more interchange we have, that over time the system will adapt. But I'm not meaning to sound naive here. I'm just, again, my focus is on how do we have a relationship where it's very clear what we stand for. We need to be strong militarily, diplomatically, economically. We are very pragmatic about our differences, but we don't let those preclude us from working in areas where we have a shared interest.
Let me see over there. Was there anybody over there? I'm trying to. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm not. Hey, Alan. How are you? Is that you? Yeah.
Why don't you give him a microphone?
Yeah. I'll have to point to people closer to the mic from now on. I'm sorry.
I mean, often the enemy inside a country is more troublesome than the enemy outside a country. And as I look at what you've described that Premier Xi is trying to accomplish, it just strikes me that there's a very good chance that there is some kind of big oops inside the country that creates something very very dangerous inside. And as you look forward, can you sort of talk a little bit about what worries you the most about what might happen inside China that could create a very serious problem for the rest of the world?
Internally? What I've focused on in my book is the economic and environmental issues, which are both significant flashpoints and areas of public concern. And so in China, there is the concern about economic growth, you know, the need to create the 10 to 12 million new jobs that they look to create every year. And they have, you know, they have a number of really significant headwinds, one of which is, you know, demographics and the aging and, you know, are they going to get old before they get rich, that kind of thing. So they've got these economic challenges, these environmental challenges, you know, the property rights challenges, the corruption, those kinds of things. I think that I focus the most on the economic area. And I think there had been many that speculated and said, you know, there had been this agreement between the public and the leadership of the Communist Party, jobs or economic growth for stability, you know, and so I think some people had speculated that if there was a serious economic problem, that would pose a threat to the Communist Party. I, for one, believe that you will find that this administration will and this leadership team will be able to hold together as long as they're focusing on the problems. And I think I am a cautious optimist that they are able and capable enough that they are going to persevere through the economic bumps. But there are bound to be bumps in the road. No one, no economy has ever been able to outlaw, you know, economic gravity. And as long as you have financial markets and governments and economies, there are going to be flawed government policies that lead to bubbles and excesses that lead to financial crises. So, you know, at some time, China's going to have a financial crisis, and every country does. So the key is, you know, will they solve the problem before the excesses become so great that they spill over and really cause a big problem in the underlying economy? And will they manage this properly? And again, I'm cautiously optimistic that they will. What Xi Jinping, you know, the way he would, I'm sure, answer the question is focused on corruption, because he was very candid at the beginning and said he thought that the biggest threat to the survival of the Communist Party was this corruption over this last 10 or 12 years that had really gotten way out of hand. And all parts of society, in the military selling commissions just like they'd done in the British military years ago, in the news media taking payments to write favorable stories, you know, in different parts of academia, just everywhere. And so this has been a really broad crackdown, and the guy who's leading it for him, Wang Xishang, recognizes that just striking fear in dealing with that isn't enough. They need a different legal system. They need a different set of values. They've got a whole series of programs, and this is going to take time.
Let me ask, on this side, yes, right here. Sorry.
I wondered if you could address some of China's hacking, cyber activity, and alternatively, if you can ask them if they could release Hillary's emails. No, I'm being facetious in the last, but sorry. Yeah.
So you should audition for John Stewart's next job, you know, replacement. You know, the very good line. This is another one that's hard for me to be brief. I'll be as brief as I can, because cyber gets conflated, and there's so many things going on at once. Okay, there is the privacy issue, which is very important in this country, which is, you know, governments using technology to help with law enforcement, whether it's domestically or to counteract you know, to terrorism or for espionage. Okay, so you've got the privacy issue, which is very big. Then you've got espionage, and all major countries, you know, engage in collect information about others, and they use technology. And technology has in recent years been the most reliable, you know, information intelligence that governments get. So all governments do that. China does it. We do it. We want to hope we do it better than the other guys. So that's a big issue. You get into what Walter raised with me earlier, which is, you know, the internet and censorship. And then you get into the national security laws that each country has, which is recognizing that technology can be used to gather information, that the Chinese have now proposed in draft form a very broad cyber or national security law, which is modeled to a certain respect after our CFIUS restriction. You know, and we don't let certain Chinese technologies into the U.S. And so then the question is, and I think this can be very dangerous if huge parts of economies around the world are walled off for the national security reasons. Now we get into the area that I focus on the most, and which I think is the most serious and destructive economic issue between the U.S. and China, which is cyber theft, which is states or companies breaking into the computers of another company and stealing technology. And this is can be much more harmful than just copying a patent, and because when you get in, you can find out what the latest state-of-the-art factory is and build it before, you know, or very soon after the competitor builds it. Or if you're bidding on an oil lease or whatever, you find out what the other guy's going to bid on. Now, this is there. It's hard to find over the last 10 years a U.S. company that hasn't had its computer system hacked by someone entity in China. Now, it's hard to pin it down, because China is a country that's more run by men than even laws today. It's lawless to a certain extent. And that's what the big focus is on, corruption. So there's plenty of hacking that goes on one Chinese company over another Chinese company. But this is serious. And I would say this, I have heard no one credibly argue that the U.S. government or U.S. companies break into other companies around the world or Chinese companies and steal technology. And yet, as we work to solve this problem, which really plays to people's concerns that China doesn't play fair, so it's very explosive, as we work to solve this problem, we have a hard time getting common ground, not only with China, but on a multilateral basis. Because a way to deal with this is dealing with it with China directly, because ultimately, they've got a big interest as we do, because I don't know how a global economic system functions unless we have rules of the road here. But the best solution is to do it on a multilateral basis. But because some of the revelations that came out about Snowden and some of our practices have been conflated with this, the United States of America has lost the high ground here. And again, so I just keep, so rather than just answering your question simply, I want to say, when we talk about cyber, let's not conflate it with some of the other things that are going on. You know, those are all important issues. And also cyber warfare, cyber terrorism. We've got common interests with China in doing things to protect ourselves against rogue states or criminals or those that would want to destabilize us or the global economy. But the one issue that I think is most explosive, and I don't think our government has come up with the right way of dealing with it, because just indicting, you know, PLA officers in China that are never going to see the inside of a U.S. court, I think, I'm not sure that helps solve the problem, but it does sure make life more difficult for U.S. companies trying to operate in China.
So should the U.S. government cyber retaliate against the PLA as it would if the PLA had sent a missile into our company?
Well, I would just simply say that I think that when I understand that we have had information stolen, okay, or gathered by whoever does it, that we should be doing everything we can. So when I hear that, for instance, that the U.S. government personnel files, that information has, someone has broken in and taken that, my first reaction is to be unhappy with my government, okay, for not doing a better job of protecting and hardening that. And my second thing is to hope that my government is doing everything they can to gather all the information they should be gathering. And I don't even think of that as retaliation. I think, you know, if there's a cyber attack, okay, you know, if someone tries to bring down, you know, our financial system or power grid or whatever, then that's warfare. And there needs to be retaliation.
And my last question, a few minutes ago, I think in the context of the Iran deal, but it's a larger context, you said that on complex issues, if you're going to solve them, you're going to have to do negotiations, and you will end up at a solution that is not perfect. Has our nation become the political parties, especially on the extremes, become too intolerant of the notion of compromise and finding practical, pragmatic, and sometimes imperfect solutions?
Yeah, well, amen. You know, when you look at, I could go through the issues that I know the best that we need to solve to put our economy on a track where we can go above 2%. And restore economic competitiveness. And so if you look at the fiscal situation, if you look at the kinds of things we need to do with healthcare, social security, immigration reform, training, education, there's a whole series of things. But if you could take reasonable people on both sides of the aisle, and if they weren't going to run for office again, put them in a room, and they would solve the problem. And so the question that I have, and it's not just the U.S. I look around the world. I look at China. I look at the U.S. I look at Europe. I look at Japan. I see the policies we have in place aren't the ones that are going to let us be successful in the past, won't let us be successful in the future. And some of the things you need to do are politically unpopular. And so the key is going to be, how do our political systems work? And the fact is that we are, as a nation, polarized. Congress reflects the nation. We don't get our facts in the same place. We cable TV, when you look at, I tell the story all the time that I have a brother that gets his news from Fox and a mother who gets her news from the New York Times editorial page, you know, or whatever. So they're just working off different sets of facts. So what we need to solve this is we need something for people to come together. And I believe in our system, and I believe ultimately we're going to get and need that kind of leadership. But right now, the gerrymandering that's gone along with the redistricting, that's corruption. And it drives both parties to extremes. So I think we've got, you know, we've got four political parties in the U.S. You know, the moderate or mainstream Republicans and Democrats, and then we got the crazies on each side. And so I've got no use whatsoever for people that say, you know, the ideologues, you know, I'm a purist, my way or the highway. Because if you're not willing to compromise, we're never going to solve any of these things.
Thank you very much. As Ben Franklin said, compromisers may not make great heroes, but they make great democracies. You've made a great democracy. We hope the Aspen Institute has been a place where people can come together like that. This being our last event of the season before we go have our farewell party, I want to thank you for reiterating that. There were a few more people with questions. I can promise you, all of your answers are in this book, and the book is for sale right there, and he'll sign it for you. Thank you, Secretary Paulson.
You've been listening to a live broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series from the Aspen Institute, featuring the Institute's president and CEO, Walter Isaacson, in conversation with Hank Paulsen, current chairman of the Paulsen Institute and former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Support for the McCloskey Speaker Series broadcast comes from Penny Evans Carruth, with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at 379-9133. This talk and all of our coverage of the Aspen Institute's McCloskey Speaker Series can be found on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.